This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Somebody once remarked, the best cure for insomnia is a Monday morning. Well, not for everybody. Chronic insomnia is a sleep disorder that prevents people from falling asleep or staying asleep. Roughly 60 million Americans suffer from it every year, and it disproportionately affects women and people over 65. Insomnia can paralyze daily routines, ruin marriages and careers, and it also comes with a host of stigmas. Science knows relatively little about how it works or why it afflicts some people and not others, and there's a debate over treatments. Today we'll hear from one insomniac about her personal journey through a lifetime of sleeplessness, and a bit later from two professionals who'll tell us about the latest findings and field your questions. So, insomniacs, what do you do to deal with it? Tell us your story. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can weigh in on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, what's an honorary doctorate good for anyway? But first, insomnia, and we begin with Gail Green, professor of English at Scripps College and author of the book Insomniac. She joins us from the studios of the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
And I guess there are a couple of questions about how you deal with your insomnia. For one thing, what do you do to try to get to sleep?
First, let me say this book is not just about me. I'm actually a pretty lucky person because I'm a professor, which means that I get to structure my own work hours. And that's, I think, really the most important thing about sleep is, like, if you have feel you have some kind of control over your hours, it's a huge advantage, because then it means you can sort of sleep when you can, take sleep, you know, when it comes along, find your own body rhythms, which are the hours of the day when you can sleep best. Some people just have a very late sleep phase syndrome. If you can sleep between 5 and noon, try to sort of make a schedule around that. I'm an academic, and also I'm not adverse to chemical help. A lot of people are adverse to sleeping pills, and I was for years and years and years, and I just found I really couldn't function on the kind of sleep that my body seemed to want to give me. It seems to want to give me 2, 3, 4, 5 hours of sleep, and I'm not Maggie Thatcher, and I'm not Napoleon Bonaparte, and these amazing short sleepers who can do on that. I'm a person with normal sleep needs, that is 6 to 7 hours. So you have to cobble together a way of life that works for you. The hardest thing I found, that stories that really broke my heart, I interviewed dozens of people for this book. Mm-hmm. I just talked to lots and lots, because insomniacs had not been talked to. That's why I named the book Insomniac, because it really centers on our experience. The hardest are people who are really caught, mangled, you know, in this kind of 9 to 5 or 8 to 5 or 7 to 5. I mean, these horrible early schedules. People who have children, they have to get them up and take them, you know, to school and so forth. This is the hardest kind. I mean, my book is really not a kind of woe is me story. My book is a very kind of lucky story of somebody who actually did manage to find a work situation where I could be productive and at the same time get the kind of sleep I need. But it's miserable. I mean, you know what it's like to have 2, 3 hours of sleep. I mean, you're good for nothing. You're just like, the glass is half empty, or the glass is totally empty.
You've written, in fact, that the first thing to go is the sense of humor.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're just good for nothing to anybody, to yourself. You know, I mean, creativity goes out the window. I cannot, string 2 words together in a sentence on those kinds of days. And I'm happiest when I'm productive and when I'm functional, when I'm out there in the world kind of doing stuff. And this makes you just sort of want to stay at home, crawl under the, you know, sheets and hide. So it's a very debilitating. It really cuts you off at the knees. I mean, obviously, there are many worse afflictions than insomnia, but sleep is the fuel of life. I mean, it's nourishing, it's restorative, and when you're deprived of it, you are really deprived of a basic kind of sustenance, sleep that knits the raveled sleeve of care, says Shakespeare.
You are also, and I guess I wasn't aware of this, but that insomniacs are not taken very seriously by doctors, by science, and indeed that there's not taken seriously by, you can't sleep, big deal.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, sleep is very invisible in this society. Sleep itself is not taken seriously. I mean, you think about the people you know who sort of boast about how little sleep they need. It's very, very aggravating, those people. But we kind of admire, you know, it's kind of a sleep machismo. We admire, you know, my students tell me I'll sleep when I'm dead, or you snooze, you lose. I mean, there are these kinds of sayings that go around college campuses, and doctors are caught up in this. I mean, think about their training, which is a kind of hazing in sleep deprivation. Doctors actually get very little training in sleep itself. So when you're dealing with a doctor, you're dealing often with somebody who really doesn't know how to deal with the problem. And when you don't know how to deal with the problem, you tend to shove it back on the patient. You know, I don't know what's wrong with you. I don't know how to fix it. Must be doing something you're doing wrong. And so it gets kind of shoved over, blame the victim, you know, kicked into our court. If you could only change your attitude, change your habits, have a better frame of mind, have a more regular schedule, you could get hold of it. And so it's something you're doing wrong. And also there's the sort of wastebasket diagnosis, which is depression, anxiety. You must be depressed. You must be anxious. Here, have an antidepressant. Well, of course, we get depressed and anxious when we can't sleep. Anybody does.
Yeah. And it used to be thought that this was a symptom of something else as opposed to being just what it is itself.
Yeah, exactly. Insomnia was seen as secondary to something else, secondary to depression, anxiety, to some kind of psychoneurosis, some kind of psychopathology. Again, sort of kick it back into the court of the person who has it. And if it's so defined as a secondary rather than a primary disorder, then why research it? You know, why spend the research money to find the neurobiology of insomnia? It's only very recently, really since about 2005, the NIH conference in 2005, that it was acknowledged to be a primary disorder, truly a primary disorder. I mean, it's been in the DSM as primary since 1994, but it was really kind of discussed as something we have to look at in a neurobiological way at that conference. Very exciting conference.
We're asking Gail Green's fellow insomniacs in the audience to call and tell us how they cope with their condition. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Let's begin with Emily. Emily's calling from Ledger in Connecticut.
Yeah, hi. I have suffered from insomnia for years. And, you know, I tried meditation, I tried reading a book, you know, everything, and nothing ever helped. And it was really a problem for me until when my daughter was born, it actually became an asset because I was used to being up all night. I had no problems, well, less problems functioning the next day than my husband, who always has had, like, a good night's sleep, you know? So I just wanted to say that, you know, definitely having a history of insomnia helped me through those sleepless nights with my newborn.
So there wasn't the usual resentment that one partner has to get up and deal with a crying baby.
Yeah, no, I just did it voluntarily because I was used to being up all night anyway. So.
Well, I guess that's a silver lining, though I suspect your daughter's now old enough that this is no longer helping.
She's 8 months old.
Ah.
So she's sleeping through the night, and I'm not. So the first time when my husband was sleeping, the baby was sleeping, the dog was sleeping, and I wasn't. Then I knew that she was past being a newborn, and she's now, you know, on to bigger things. So.
Emily, you must be exhausted.
It's there are some long days. No lie, it's be long days, especially because I have an hour commute, and I have called in tired once.
You called in tired.
if I was up all night with the baby, or you know, whatever. And you have an hour commute, what can you do? If you need to watch out for the safety of yourself and for others on the road, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks very much for the call. Good luck with it.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And let's see if we can go now to Jim. And Jim's with us from California.
Yeah. Hi. Yeah, I have a little trick I use. I have a small cassette, and I have earphones that I put in my ear so I don't disturb my wife, and I listen to a not-too-exciting narrative, usually history or something that's not, you know, a little bit...
Maybe somebody reading the Manhattan phone book.
Well, no, it can't be that boring, because then it won't. The point is, it's got to interrupt my train of thought.
I see.
Because that's what is sort of the obsessive nature that prevents me from falling asleep.
Gail Green, have you tried that?
Oh, have I tried it? That is one of my time-honored devices. I'm so glad you mentioned that. I love memoirs
and certain kinds of
novels that aren't...
You can pick them up any place.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't matter if you fall asleep. You can't be lying there waiting to see what comes out next, you know, page turners, cliffhangers. It just, they don't work. I mean, there are some books by Alice Hoffman that have kept me awake till dawn. But where, you know, and it's got to be read in a kind of soothing way. And it's wonderful to get your mind onto another story. I think it evokes the inner child in us, you know, tell me a story. I love these things. I'm completely addicted to them. I need tapes. I can't use the newer technologies because you wake up and you're at the end of the novel. I mean, I have to wake, you know, the tapes are shorter. You wake up and you just can wind back the next night. But they're very, very comforting and very interesting. It's a way of sort of keeping up with what's going on, and, you know, for me, in contemporary fiction and nonfiction writing. So I'm glad you mentioned that.
Jim, maybe you and Gail should get together and make a...
compare.
You know, well, you know, an Insomniac's all-time hit parade.
I thought you were sleep together.
Family
show, Jim.
Yeah, we could share earphones.
I think there are a lot of people who have found their way to this technique. Since from my interviews, I've heard of quite a few. Some people actually like to watch things. The Golf Channel. That's wonderful. I watch DVDs before I go to sleep. You're not supposed to watch anything, but I like visuals as well. That's before I go to sleep. But when I wake up in the middle of the night, it's the books on tape.
Jim, thanks very much for the call, and good reading.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. If you've been tossing and turning at night, fighting off insomnia, what have you tried? We'll come back and talk with about two kinds of solutions, medical and behavioral, and we'll take more of your calls. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And you can also check out what other listeners are saying on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about insomnia this hour. Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation and tell us what you do to deal with the problem, is 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Our guest is Gail Green, author of the book Insomniac. We got this email from Virginia. Little money and no drugs, and it's worked for 20 years for me. Buy two electric timers, plug one in an electric blanket, plug in bedside lamp in the other, one old newspaper folded in fourths to a rather boring article one can read on one side and fall asleep with the warmth of the blanket and never have to turn it or the lamp off. If that should fail, BBC or some such overnight, no music on the radio turned almost too low to understand what is said. Have you tried the two timers technique at all, Gail, do you think?
This is so amazing to me because everybody's story is so different and everybody's solution is so different. Warmth of a blanket, no, I need it cold. Temperature actually needs to decline in sleep, and it's kind of the trigger for sleep is this decline of falling temperature. And so warmth of the blanket, counterintuitive, but hey, if it works, go with it. I was also really interested in one of the earlier callers who talked about motherhood as helping her insomnia, because many women, of course, are... You know, it precipitates insomnia. So that story was very different as well. I mean, we all have to, you know, there is no one-size-fits-all solution to insomnia. There's no one-size-fits-all explanation for insomnia. We have to find our own way with this, find whatever works. So these stories that come in, I love them. They're ingenious. They're inventive. People have really worked out things that, you know, work for them. And that's what we all have to do.
Joining us now are Dr. Ronald Chervin and Todd Arnott. They work in tandem at the Sleep Disorder Center at the University of Michigan to address the medical and psychological issues that surround insomnia. They're with us now from member station WUOM in Ann Arbor. Nice to have you with us on the program today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And who's who? First of all, Dr. Chervin, so we can hear your voice.
Yes.
And then
pleasure to be here.
Todd Arnott.
I'm Todd, right here.
Okay, we can tell your voice is a little bit different. To begin with, what do you make of Gail Green's criticism that medicine and science often don't take sleep or insomnia, for that matter, very seriously?
I find that really resonates very accurately. We see a lot of sleep patients at our sleep disorder center, and the large majority have had their problems for many, many years. Many have complained to various people, including sometimes their physicians, about it and not gotten a satisfying answer.
She writes in her book, and I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say it's truly something that's under-recognized, as I think our guest alluded to. Doctors don't learn about sleep as they go through college, and so they're often reluctant to ask their patients about sleep, and so it often gets missed in the context of a primary care setting. And so it's only after years of struggling that patients finally end up in our specialty clinics looking for answers, searching for solutions.
Well, she also pointed out that doctors don't get a lot of sleep in college, and even less when they're interns.
Yes, that's very true, and we actually have some research evidence that suggests that after a month of heavy call, they may be as impaired as a low dose of alcohol in certain performance tests. So we know that it's quite impairing.
Are there psychological issues that are linked to insomnia?
Well, as you both alluded to, there's definitely this cyclical nature that goes on where you don't get a lot of sleep, and that triggers a low mood. And then when you have a low mood, it makes your sleep worse, and the two sort of feed off each other. And that's probably, in the studies that we've looked at, that's probably the most robust effect of sleep deprivation, is its effects directly on mood, whether it increases anxiety or whether it increases depression. The mood effects are quite robust.
There are also a lot of sleep clinics around. I understand that those are largely to treat a condition called sleep apnea, where sort of a mechanical problem keeps waking you up at night. You deprive yourself of oxygen. But do sleep clinics address insomnia per se?
They do. They do very much. In fact, the main complaints that bring people to sleep clinics are either that they're too sleepy during the day or that they have some trouble sleeping at night. And one of the first things we do with either of those complaints is try to diagnose the hypersomnia in the first case or the insomnia in the second case. And there can be a lot of different reasons for insomnia specifically, and they range from medical causes to psychological causes to primary insomnia or psychophysiological insomnia, which a great number of people have, which I think Gail Green was talking about when she said that insomnia is not necessarily secondary to something else.
Mm-hmm. Gail Green, I know it's part of the research for your book, you went to a sleep clinic, and it was a strange experience.
It wasn't very satisfying. First of all, I was supposed to sleep between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., and my usual sleep hours are more like 3 a.m. to 10 a.m. And so, and I was supposed to sleep on my back so they could check for breathing, and I never sleep on my back. So all in all, I think they looked at it. They actually saw maybe about 3 hours of my sleep. And also with an insomniac, our sleep patterns are so erratic, so various from, you know, night to night, that one night doesn't really tell much. Everybody, you know, acknowledges this, but of course no HMO is going to fit the bill for more than one night, because the clinics are extremely expensive. So the paperwork took a year, about a calendar year, from the time my physician had put in the request to the time that I actually saw, you know, consulted with somebody at the clinic. And I kept thinking, gee, it's really, nobody really much cares in this healthcare system whether I am sleeping or not. In fact, I wasn't sleeping very much at that point. And it just seemed so non-urgent and so perfunctory. And then at the end of it, I got advice on sleep hygiene, which I could have read on any one of, you know, many, many web pages. Even, you know, this is in the air. I didn't need to go to a clinic to hear this.
Let's see.
So it was not satisfactory, I'm sorry to say. And a lot of insomniacs I talked to have been disillusioned with the clinics in terms of insomnia. For apnea, for movement disorders, this is very, very important to, you know, screen this out. But for insomnia, I did not feel a lot of enthusiasm from insomniacs.
Yeah, let me just jump in here and say that not all sleep clinics are also created equal. I think it's important to go to an accredited clinic.
Yeah.
And there are resources out there available to do some research and look in to see how good your clinic is. A good website for information is www.sleepeducation.com. And there you can find a list of accredited centers that you can expect would treat insomnia in probably a more appropriate way than Gail's perhaps was dealt with. Certainly with insomnia, our first line of defense is not usually a sleep study, unless we feel strongly that something like sleep apnea might be causing the insomnia. It's often to go in alternative routes, and not all sleep centers have clinics devoted to insomnia specifically. Ours is one that does, but they're certainly in short supply across the country.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Kevin. Kevin with us from Fresno in California.
Yeah, hey, how you doing?
Okay.
This topic is so... The inability to sleep has all but destroyed my life. And I'll try not to get too emotional here, but over the years, I have gone... My body seems to work not on a 24-hour clock, but on a 30 to 36-hour clock. If I wake up at 6 a.m. one morning and get to work and work during the day, and instead of being tired and ready for bed at 10 or 11 o'clock that night, I'm not tired until 3 or 4 the next morning. And then I've got to get back up at 6. And sometimes I can't sleep for a couple, three. The longest I've ever gone was 4 straight days without sleep, and then I'll sleep like the dead. And it's not uncommon for me to oversleep my alarm by not a few minutes, but by 4 or 5 or 6 hours. I have lost countless jobs due to not being able to sleep or get up in time to get to work, and after not sleeping a couple of days, or going in on my second or third day without sleep and not being able to perform. I've lost relationships. I've lost my relationships with my parents because I can't hold a job and I can't think straight and I can't see straight, and I've lost my relationship with a good woman, my son's mother, and my son. I don't see him, and it all comes down to sleep, the inability to sleep, and then when I do, I sleep like I'm dead, and I don't know where to go, what to do, who to talk to. I can't get anybody. For the last 10 years, I've been trying to get someone to kind of take this seriously, and I can't find that. And this is, I'm getting, well, I've been up for, God, almost 30 hours now.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
But it's a constant thing, Neil. It's constant. It's been this way as far back as I can remember. I'm in my mid-30s, and it's been this way as far back as I can remember, being a little kid getting in trouble for still being awake at 11 or 12 o'clock at night, and I just can't sleep.
Gail,
you were right. I wrote the book. I mean, I'm hearing you, and you know, my heart is breaking for you. And you're speaking for so many people. You are not alone. There are so many people whose lives have been destroyed by this, who end up, you know, on disability, who can't hold jobs, who can't hold relationships, and it's just not their fault. And nobody is hearing them. Nobody's taking this seriously. You obviously have a sleep pattern that's unusual, and employers hear this. I mean, lighten up. I mean, let us do flex time. Let us do the work on our own time. Don't insist that everybody, you know, be there 9 to 5. Some employers are getting this message and allowing sort of napping and allowing people to work from home. You get more out of workers doing this. And friends, listen, you know, friends and family and relationships, this is not something we're bringing on ourselves or something we could get hold of if we'd only observe better sleep habits. This is something that has got us, you know, in its grip and really can just, I, you know, what you said is so eloquent, and thank you for saying it.
Dr. Chervin, Todd Arndt, yeah. any advice for Kevin?
Well, I have a slightly different take on it. I think that the problems that Kevin is describing are certainly serious, and I certainly hear him. But the messages I want to give him is that most of our patients who come in, even with a lifelong history of insomnia like that, can be helped and can be helped effectively. In fact, you know, with all respect, Yael Greene's experience aside, one of the reasons that people like me come into the sleep field is because it's one of the most rewarding areas of medicine. Our patients, by and large, are very happy patients when we're done treating them. And I don't think that Kevin's, the chronicity or the long-term nature of it or even the amount that it's impacted his life means that we couldn't do something about it. And in particular, for example, people who have a lot of trouble going to sleep at night and a lot of trouble getting up in the morning, if that was some of the pattern that he was describing, may have a condition called delayed sleep phase syndrome. And it's believed to relate to the clock inside our brains. And
That becomes exactly how it feels, and that's how I've tried to describe it to people. Like I said at the beginning of the call, I don't work on a 24-hour clock. My body seems to work on a 30 to 36-hour clock.
And can that clock be reset?
Well, we have all kinds of strategies to effectively help with that. Short of asking society to change their tolerance, and I'm not arguing against that. I do think employers need to be sensitive to people with medical disorders, including sleep disorders. But there are all kinds of things ranging, including regular scheduling, sometimes modifying your schedule for a short period to get back on a regular schedule, sometimes using bright light in the morning effectively. We have a lot of good approaches that can be effective for this.
Tend to make me angry.
Kevin, I can't tell you how much we all wish you the best of luck and a good night's sleep.
Well, thank you very much, and I hope there will be links and information on the website I can check out.
I hope so. And one of the links we will provide is obviously the one that we just heard about from the University of Michigan there, but also some links that Gail Green has brought up in her writings for people with these conditions to talk to each other and find out that they're not alone. But thank you very much for the call, Kevin.
Thank you, Neil.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We're talking about insomnia with Gail Green, the author of Insomniac, also with Dr. Ronald Chervin and Todd Arnett, who are with us from the University of Michigan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Bill on the line. Bill from Portland, Oregon.
I have a question about how this might be passed on through heredity and so forth. I've noticed it's more and more as the older I got, but my father, I think, had it, didn't acknowledge it. It was just part of his lifestyle, he used to call it, only sleeping about 5 hours a night. I do about 3 to 4. And now I have a daughter that's in her 30s, and she's starting to suffer from it also.
Any information on the hereditary nature of insomnia?
Well, that's an emerging field, actually, of research. And there's some preliminary studies, at least in the insomnia field, to suggest that a good portion of it is hereditary. And the way I sort of think about it is, I think there are people out there who do inherit, a sensitive sleep system that really can be perturbed quite easily and can cause problems for them chronically in terms of their sleep. And we're starting to understand that is the case for at least a significant portion of people. But it's a young field and it's growing, and we only have a few research articles out on it currently.
Well, thanks. And the only other thing I wanted to say about the condition that my daughter and I both have is that one peculiar thing is we absolutely cannot take sleep during the daytime hours, during the, you know, any time the sun is out. And it's almost like we have an internal clock that knows that sunrise during the summer months is even earlier than it is during the winter months, and that affects our sleep patterns. It's really bizarre. I could be just walking dead in the middle of the day, and I cannot sleep.
Well, sun certainly is the strongest time giver to that brain, that internal brain clock everybody's got, that sort of governs when our body feels sleepy and when it feels alert. So you just may have a particularly sensitive system.
Yeah, blackout curtains do not work.
Well, Bill, again, good luck to you.
Thank you.
And Gail Green, before we let you go, what's been the reaction to your book? I know that one of the great things that this has done is to get people to realize they're not alone.
Yeah, I've gotten some wonderful letters from people that have said, you know, this book is an enormous comfort, and it's helped me through many sleepless nights, and it's given me ideas of how to, you know, ways to work with my problem. I was really shocked when I started it to realize there was no insomnia advocacy group. I mean, there's advocacy groups for everything, for narcolepsy and restless leg syndrome, certainly, and they affect far fewer people. This affects millions and millions of people and causes enormous misery to millions. And we haven't organized on our own behalf. And it was one of the things I hoped to do with this book was to get people talking to them, to each other, and to share their experiences. And, you know, funding goes to patients who make noise. I mean, bottom line is this – condition is very little funded. There were $20 million spent by the NIH in 2005 on insomnia research. There was $123 million spent by Sanofi Aventis to advertise Ambien that same year. So $20 million to research insomnia versus $123 million to advertise one drug. This is a condition that needs a whole lot more research. And maybe if insomniacs can talk to each other, I have a web page blog that I'm trying to get going. And it's called sleepstarved.org. And I would really appreciate people to come to this and, you know, share the kinds of things you know about your own condition, ways you found of dealing with it, and maybe we can even find out, you know,
Gail
what's
Green,
going wrong.
Gail Green, a professor of English at Scripps College, her book, again, Insomniac, and there's a link to the Sleep Starved blog on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. We'd like to thank her, and also we'd like to thank Todd Arnott and Dr. Ronald Chervin of the Sleep Disorder Center at the University of Michigan. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.